accession number 18463, reel 16.
Don Barrett, reel 16.
Yes, it's the 1st of December, and we're in this paddy field. And I think I spoke earlier of the reporters, and I may probably have got the name of one of them wrong. It was Alan Wicker, who was the shorter chap, and of course Randolph Churchill, who was the big hefty guy in the big duffel coat. That morning, colour sergeant came round and wanted a blanket from everybody because I think it was D Company, I can't be sure, but I believe it was D Company. Their vehicle had broken down, been burnt, and as had the vehicle with all the greatcoats in, and they'd lost all their blankets. And I'd like to say that my lads gave willingly their blankets, but they didn't. They were pretty unwilling to give their blankets because they were a little bit miffed at having to burn all their extra stuff at Tuileries, their blankets and what have you, and there was loads of stores going up in flames, and they were not too pleased, but they all gave in the end. That left us with two blankets and a sleeping bag, which is quite honestly not sufficient for a Korean winter. As the day went on, the road, we were beside the road, began to increase in traffic, and we realised it was secondive. They supposed to have made a stand just north of Sunchon, about Chop Tong way, and held the line there, but there wasn't enough of them. And their other regiment, which had come out via Anju, wasn't even on the same road. So they were going through vehicles loaded with people, lightly wounded, and a pattern tank came along. And we wondered why this chap was sort of hanging on the side underneath the turret. It looked like he tucked himself under the turret. And it was going very slowly, stopped just down past us. And apparently what had happened, he was on the back of the tank, and the crew had rotated the turret, and they trapped him underneath. He looked like he was trapped by his body, but I was told later it was only his arm. And they were trying to find some medical person who could cut his arm off and release him. I don't know what happened. He went on down, and presumably the MO did that, I guess. I don't know, but I guess that he did the job for them and got him out. And as I say, the traffic was increasing. And it's probably fair to say that we'd perhaps lost all confidence in the American Army and the Rock Army and everybody else, and we were only, our own morale was very, very high, because our confidence was in 27 Brigade, Brigadier Code and Colonel Mann. As far as I'm concerned, and I'm sure the rest of them would agree, they couldn't do anything wrong. They were looking after us, keeping us fairly compact, and also, of course, the Middlesex, having been the only battalion involved in the Cunery Pass affair, were quite tails were up. We'd been very lucky with casualties. Only, I think it was 27 to be exact, but at that time we thought it was about 30 casualties, which was pretty good, of which only two had died. One was the officer whose name eludes me just at this moment of time, up at Cunery, and the one shot by the American tanks, who died of wounds at St John. We were pretty tails up, I must admit, and we probably thought that we were the only people in Korea that were doing any good. That's a good sign in a infantry battalion. I mean, it's never true, of course, but it's a good feeling to have. And perhaps I should here, just at this moment, just remind ourselves that the brigade was just three infantry battalions. We had no supporting arms whatsoever, no field ambulance, no artillery, no tanks, no engineers, and no, more important perhaps than anything else, no transport vehicles for the troops. The only transport was the if you were lucky, you still had two, three tonners left in a company and a 1500. A lot didn't, like only had one three-tonner left, so we could never move the troops anyway. And in fact, our supplies, you'd have to move them in two lifts, in actual fact, so the trucks would go off, drop it on the side of the road, come back and pick up the rest of it. Now, unfortunately, at this particular time, the brigade has got separated from its tail. So people like the infantry workshops B echelons and things like that with all the main supplies are over on the Sukchon Road. They've come down, because we were changed course, they've come down the other side. And we can't, that again was another thing where you could unload the vehicles and move the troops a little bit and, at a time, but we got no chance to do that. Day wore on, and about, I guess, in the afternoon, about 3 p.m., something like that, we heard that the Argylls were off across the river to join the 1st Cavalry Division, and the Australians were moving south. They'd been over the other side of the river trying to stop the refugees and infiltrators and goodness knows what, but they weren't having any luck because there were so many of them and they couldn't tell who the infiltrators were. Plus the fact, of course, the bridges were just another point of crossing the river. The rivers were frozen solid. You could cross anywhere down along their length. So the Argylls have gone. The Aussies are going and may well have gone by this time. And we're now taking over the defence of Chaisan, where Corps is. My guess is that this would have been TAC Corps, TAC HQ Corps, because I reckon the main corps probably moved south with 2 Death, but I don't know that for sure. We moved over across the road, an upper pathway, and on the way up, I noticed the camp bed on the left-hand side. I thought, oh, that's handy. I've never seen anything like that abandoned before. We got up on the top, and we're on a ridge of fields, ploughed fields, looking down across a big valley, a road just below us with a little village there, all very quiet. And in fact, everywhere suddenly gone quiet, because the situation at the moment is where yesterday we'd been behind the line when we'd arrived back, and first thing in the morning, second div having passed through us, we're now the front line again. So we dig in well. There's a concern that of tanks, we might come under tank attack, because it was thought that so many have been lost with 2 Div, who'd lost virtually most of their vehicles, all of their artillery. The only artillery that got out were the, by a stroke of luck and very great luck, the Army 8-inch guns. They got out except one gun, they lost one gun. The rest of all the artillery was lost in the Kinnery Pass. The only regiment that got out was the 23rd Regiment, Freeman's Regiment, and they had decided not to go down the pass, and quite rightly so, and gone off down the Anjou Road, and were now on the other road. I don't know if they were coming back across. I expect they were going straight to Pyongyang, because 2 Div was now going, as they told us, and we didn't really believe them, they were going down to South Korea. I mean, we thought that was just something they were saying, but they were, in fact, off down through Pyongyang to South Korea to reform. We didn't believe it, of course. And that night was... I was on the first stag that night, having been last the previous night. And I should point out, we're very short in numbers. We've only got 4 NCOs. Albert's a platoon commander. So we haven't got a platoon sergeant as such. So Ken Partridge is section commander and acting platoon sergeant. So we've only got 4 of us to do the night guard. So we divided up into segments, probably about 3 hours each, because the nights are getting much longer now. So we do the prowling, as it were, around to make sure that the sentries are awake and the lads are on. We didn't have 50%. Stand to this night. We had all the LMG posts manned, so we had the 3 LMG posts were manned, and the rest took it in turns to man that post. We got the rocket launcher up there as well, and we dug a rather fancy pit for the rocket launcher just in case the tanks did arrive up over the ridge there. And we had a very quiet night. Now, during my stag, I went off down the track and picked up this camp bed. First I'd ever seen it. Was a joy, so I got it, and it got a great, horrible, great rent in it. I got it fixed up there, set it up, and I thought, well, I'm going to have a night on bed now, first time for a very long time, which was a terrible mistake, because being raised up above the ground, the cold gets underneath and the top and attacks you all the way around. But after my stag, I got it and I stuck it all night long. I shouldn't have done, really. And the next thing I know, it's the morning, and Albert and the signaller Tom Wilson, waking me up. Albert was doing a stag as a platoon commander, he was doing a stag because they're so short these days. And in platoon HQ, radio watch rather than stag. And they were laughing and at me and laid on this camp bed. And I'd sort of swung over on my stomach and they were having a little chat. And the drill was that you didn't leave the person until they actually got out of their sleeping bag. They had to be out of their sleeping bag and moving about before you went off and left them. But I mean, people like myself who they trusted, they didn't bother, they walked on, because I mean, I never failed them. Well, the next thing I remember, I'm laying on my stomach on this wretched camp bed, and I can feel a faint tapping on my back, just as if like a bird or something like that walking up and down my back, tap, 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 tap. And it gets harder and harder and harder and harder, and I suddenly swung round, and glaring down at me is the company commander, Major Allen, with the unfortunate name at that time of Codsoys, and I'm sure that's probably how I would have referred to it at that moment when I told the tale. But looking up, and he's banging me now on the chest, and I get up, and I realise I'd done a darn stupid thing. I'd taken my boots off, they're laid under the bed. More important, in the dark I got disorientated, and I placed the camp bed on the forward slope. I wasn't at the rear where I thought I was. I was on the forward slope. So we've got an NCO laying on a camp bed with his boots off and asleep when he should have been at stand two. And I must say, I felt absolutely terrible. I got out and fell about all over the place. Staggered, went down my knees and pulled my boots on, and generally in a fair old state there. And got into my pit. And company commander was going round then, and if anybody was asleep, obviously he wasn't too pleased. But they were all sitting up in their sleeping bags with their hoods up over their heads, and you know, trying to keep warm. It was very, very cold. And I was distraught. I mean, I'd never ever been caught on asleep when I should have been on duty ever. And I must say, I'd caught many people of my own and just given them a good kick and or a push and woken them up, and that was it. They were as worried as I was about it. Shortly after, Jimmy Wilde, CSM Jimmy Wilde, came over and said, come with me. Took me off for a walk away from the platoon. He said, well, what the devil happened? And I said, well, I don't know. I haven't got the faintest idea. I just felt this tapping in the middle of my back, and I swung over, and it was the company commander. I was woken up, no doubt about that. And he said, well, Albert's saying that he'll take responsibility for it because he should have made sure you got out of bed. And, you know, we talked about this wretched camp bed and why it was on the forward slope. And I said, well, I can't have that. I can't have Albert taking the blame. Regular soldier, one of the finest now platoon commander, finest chap I've ever come across. And he said, well, that's what he said. He's going to stick up for you. So I said, well, I can't have that. I shall, you know, I'm obviously going to be busted. And that's the end of my sort of career. And of course, in the company as well, because the policy was that when an NCO was busted, he was sent off to another company. He didn't stay in the company. So I guessed I'd be off to another rifle company and just a section, in a section. And he said, well, I'll do what I can with the company commander. Went off. Now, I better just enlarge on this story now, because I was never charged. It hung over me all the time I was in Korea, this thing. I just couldn't get it out of my mind that I'd been asleep on guard. And gradually, I began to hear that apparently the company commander's view was that I was unconscious. I apparently had turned over in my sleeping bag, just put my face down for a minute, and I was absolutely unconscious. So that's why was just a faint tapping on my back. He thought I was dead, in actual fact, because he'd been banging away for so long trying to wake me up. But I think, funny enough, he did save my life. He got me back to life again, and then of course the cold air had revived me. But it was a terrible experience, and I felt ashamed of myself for it. But as I say, everybody else in the company was charged who had a misdemeanor that day, which is perhaps they were asleep or something like that. But I was the only one, and I never was. And I'm sure it was a company commander that because he woke or tried to wake me up, and I think he was convinced. That night, an order came round that nobody was to ever put their sleeping bag up above their waist, so it wasn't to come above your shoulders and above your head. I must admit that was an order which was very hard to put into order because it was so cold. But that was the command from the brigadier, so I can only presume that my misdemeanour had gone down to Brigade HQ and there'd been some discussion about it. And the presumption was that I was unconscious, and that's my excuse. And I'm not very proud of that particular moment, in actual fact. In fact, Jimmy Wilde had said to me, "You do realise in times gone by I could have had you shot straight away for this," and I did. I did realise that. Anyway, the day went on, and I'm in a fairly low spirits, I must admit. Everybody else is doing quite well, and I'm not feeling too happy. And suddenly my LMG post called me over, and they're down across the valley, and I guess it was 3,000 yards maybe. There's some soldiers milling about. We couldn't see who they were. We had a feeling they were rocks, but they could have been Chinese. I still think they were rocks, and events will perhaps support that. And they were getting these civilians out of the houses and putting them in little groups of, I don't know, four, five, six women with children on their backs, cuddling children and things like that. Others holding them into their, you know, around their legs and what have you. And these little groups, and we watched them, we thought, they must be going to get these civilians to dig rifle pits there and they're going to put a defensive position, you see. And we're watching them through the glasses, and suddenly the people just crumple up and fall on the ground. I can't believe it. And so you appreciate that we couldn't give any sentence at this time without putting a four-letter word. So you had a four-letter word and a word and a four-letter word, and I can't remember what I said, but basically it was, they're shooting them. And we couldn't believe it. Everybody's snatching the binoculars to have a look. And these people just crumbled up, and these chaps go walking off south. So we thought they must be rocks, and they just shot these civilians for no reason whatsoever. So we were a bit upset about this, and Elbert had come up by this time. He'd heard the shouts, and he came up and he had a quick look, and we said, "We're off. We're down there. We're going to shoot those people." And he said, "Oh, don't be stupid, it's 3,000 yards, they're on the move, by the time you get down there they'll be long gone." And he was right, he was absolutely right. But it's very upsetting to see these civilians shot down, presumably by rocks who were a little bit upset about perhaps the retreat. Anyway, the day went on, and now things have changed now. Where the previous night there had been enormous great fires and around Corps HQ, and we'd had our big fire, which we've been talking to the reporters about. It's now black and silent and you know, the normal sort of frontline atmosphere. Later on in the day, we get the word that we're going to go south. I'm not quite sure. I'd have to look in my journal to see whether it's this day or maybe earlier the next morning. I cannot be sure. I think it's probably the 2nd of December following day, we get the word that we're going south. Transport arrived. There's nothing coming through now. No, second div's gone, and we're literally the front line again. And we went off down to a road junction, and we sat around in company groups there. They'd never actually quite seen us like that before, but we were in literally company blobs, lines, and sitting on the floor waiting. And the word was that there was a roadblock down the right-hand road, and we were going to have to clear that. But the road apparently on the left was clear. So we were sitting there waiting, and it looked like B Company would be leading because we were nearest the road junction. As we're sitting there, there's a crack. Look across to A Company, and one of A Company has just shot himself in the leg with a 4-5 pistol, and we could see the pistol going down the line, getting hidden out of the way. And he went off. Well, I mean, that was a deliberate shooting, I'm sure. I mean, it goes down as accidental, but there were a number of these going on at various times. And I think he probably shot himself in the foot. Either that or he got it out and accidentally shot himself. Very easy to do, you never know. He was carted off. Shortly after that, we got an order to move. And this time we were back on, I think we were back on transport. Yes, we were back on the transport again. And we moved, I don't know, 2 or 3 miles perhaps, dumped in the paddy on the side of the road, and there for a while. And it seemed that we were going to stay overnight. And all the transport was unloaded on the side of the road, unpacked, all the bedding and all that, and the 3 tonners and 1500 rates all went off. Apparently the Argyles had been come back from the 1st Cavalry and were back at Chase Anne, and the transport was going to be used to lift them back. We went off then down a narrow road off the MSR. We're heading east now, and apparently about an 8 mile march we've got, and we were expecting trouble along the way. I don't believe that we knew that the Australians were up ahead. I can't remember anybody ever telling me that the Australians were ahead, and we were just advancing and clearing the sides of the road as we went. We got near a little village eventually, and I remember the chap now, Boris Card, his section went off to the village to reconnoitre it, came back and said, well, they'd been told, incidentally, that a village was full of dead Chinamen. The Air Force had claimed they'd killed God knows how many Chinamen in this village. Came back and he'd found a couple of dead civilians and a dead cow. And that's all that was there. And it's a rather funny thing, because many years later, this particular incident is claimed by the Australians, but they had gone through before, so maybe they did spot this. Went on down into the village. We were moving up to the left-hand side of the village, which would be like the northern side of the village. The Aussies were in the village and over the other side of the river. And we dug in on the what would be literally the northern side, which was their left flank. And positions up there were very good. We could look out over some ground and a road. We couldn't see the road, but we knew where the road was. We could see where it went in a defile between some places there, some hills there. And the aircraft were attacking there all day long. Relays of aircraft came over, napalm, cannons, bombs, a whole lot. And apparently what the Chinese army was doing, it wasn't coming down the MSR, it was coming down this secondary road and was literally passing us by, heading for Pyongyang. And shortly after that, We at this moment of time, we've only got the LMG post manned because everybody's in their trenches. So, I mean, they only needed to shout and they would have been ready at a moment's notice. And we were just waiting there, and the Australians began to withdraw back across the river. The brigadier was closing the perimeter down a little bit, and the Australian company came up on our left, which would be the western side. And then one of their MMGs came along and began to dig in just behind one of their behind their LMG posts. And I'll be quite honest, we weren't terribly pleased about that, but it meant they'd be firing over the top of the LMG post. But one can't do anything about these things, because the MMG is placed by the commanding officer. So the commanding officer of the Aussies had presumably decided that was a place for it. They fired about a half a belt to try and to judge range and what have you. And we're quite pleased having there, a couple of happy souls they were. Called back just shortly after this to the other side, to the reverse side of the slope, and the company commander gave us a chat about what was happening, how things were going on, and that we were going to spend another night there, but we'd probably withdraw the following morning. And he pointed out to us the Argyles had arrived by this time. I can't quite be sure which day is which now, but the Argyles had arrived, and they were on a pimple back behind us to the west on the opposite side of the road, and there were about 4 or 5 tanks with them. And the idea was that when the Chinese attacked us, and obviously, in the numbers would probably drive somebody or other in, either the Aussies or us, the Argyles are going to counterattack and push them back out of the way again, and we'd hold our position. And the company commander said, I'm coming back to have a look at your positions then. So there's Elbert, the 3 section commanders, and there's only one lance corporal actually on the position at this moment. South staff's that. Nice chap. And we walked back over the crest And there, to her horror, it's the LMG post. It was my LMG post, but it wasn't my section who were actually on duty at this time. Two chaps, I remember, I know their names very well. And they were standing up behind the MMG with bits of equipment dangling all around them, really looking a bit forlorn. And there was a photographer there, I couldn't believe it, in a sand-coloured uniform, pink hat and everything. And he was photographing the MMG. And the story is that he turned up, he wanted an all-Australian photograph, and he just asked them to kick everything into the bottom of the trench, and, their trench, and then stand behind what he got his all-Australian photograph. So I've got a copy of that photograph, and you can see the LMG post, and just to the right of that, I was in a single pit because I hadn't got anybody to double up with me. And you can just see the edge of my post. Well, of course, the company commander was not terribly pleased about this. And he gave a few choice words to this photographer, who sort of ran off, and our poor old forlorn lads were both charged with dereliction of duty. It wasn't really their fault. A bit sad, really, because the guy having an officer's hat on, they thought he was an officer, and he could command them about. Anyway, they got charged. The charges were never. It would be lot later, probably Christmas before they ever came up before the company commander, and also the NCO, the Lance Corporal, South Staff lad, he was charged as well, because he was the duty NCO and he'd allowed this to happen, so the three of them were charged. It has to be done, but it was a little bit unfair in that this wretched photographer who was trying to, who was, funny enough, had been up at south of Pak Chong when we'd been there, he turned up there and tried to take photographs. But I never liked people taking photographs of me. I just had that feeling that I didn't want them years later looking at it, saying, "Oh, that's old Long Barrow. Hey, oh, he got killed at so and so." So I never fancied that. Did my best to avoid it. And we're in Stuck again, really. I'm feeling a bit low, to be quite honest, because I've got two things hanging over me now. My LMG post, although it wasn't my lads, have had a little failure, and I've got this wretched sleep on duty thing hanging over me. So we had a fairly quiet day. 5 platoon went down that night to the river crossing and reported back that they could hear voices and digging over the other side. So obviously the Chinese were closing in on us. And we had a quiet night, very cold, very quiet night. No activity. I think a few mortar bombs came in on the Aussies, but certainly nothing came in on us at all, nothing whatsoever. Next morning, early, morning you'd appreciate on active service is when it gets light. Night is when it gets dark. The daylight hours and the night hours are virtually all you judge time by. And we were told that we were going to move during the middle of the morning. Hadn't got any transport. No American transport had turned up. One of the bugbears was that American commanders could never realise that we hadn't got tanks, artillery and transport, as I said earlier. And they'd give us orders to go places, and we hadn't got enough sufficient transport to go. But fortunately, an American, I thought it was a battalion, everybody even today thinks it was a battalion, of 4-2 mortars had turned up. But it couldn't possibly have been, because we know that one of their companies had been lost at Coonery and part of another one at Ansan. But there was one, maybe two companies of 4-2 mortars had turned up. And we were able to get people up on their transport, anything that moved. We were going to move on anything that could possibly move.